This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson, and I'm very excited to be speaking to Sarah Listick Goodman in Jerusalem. We tried a few weeks ago, but couldn't. So at last, we can see each other, and it's so good to see you. We are actually dedicating this program to Sarah's grandson, Yakir Yedidya Shen-Kolevsky. Is that how you pronounce it?
That's correct. That's correct.
Who unfortunately fell in battle in Gaza. And Sarah will tell us a bit about Yakir. Tell me about him, Sarah. Tell me, he was 21 years old. Is
he
that right?
He was 21, and he was very much eager to participate to defend our country. He wasn't, he was told when he was first brought in that medically he's not well, something small, therefore he can't be in battle. He wanted to be in a tank. So he went and he did 3 months of physiotherapy and then went back and they took him in open arms. And he told other kids, if you go, you have to be serious and you have to do what you have to do. Now, this meant that he wasn't with his classmates because they went ahead 3 months before him. But this just shows his sincerity and him not looking to get out of it.
Absolute some determination.
Yeah, they like to have a desk job. No, this young man, he knew his father had been in the tank and his uncle and his own brothers and his friends. And he was, the army gave him an outstanding award for being super at some point. They do that sometimes. And all his friends after his death keep sending messages how much they miss him. One young man actually thanked my daughter and her husband for bringing him, for being his parents, because he was such a help.
Oh, so, isn't that
a lot of wonderful, wonderful things they say about him, yes.
And
now, Yakir has, my daughter has 5 children. Yakir is the 4th boy, and after that, 2 years later, his sister was born. And his sister really misses him, because they were the youngest two and they were very close.
I'm sure. What a loss in the family. And also a loss for his yeshiva, because I saw that a lot of the boys from his yeshiva actually did fall in battle in Gaza.
There was a big article in one of the newspapers that there were 8 from Yerucham yeshiva, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but they've come from all kinds of places. There are other yeshivas that have had losses. I don't have to tell you.
Sarah, quite honestly, they are fighting, all of them are fighting an existential battle for Israel and for all of us in the diaspora.
Really,
and really,
so true.
From the deepest part of my soul, I thank Yakir for what he did that we might live and go on.
Yes.
What
he was
like
very
to
proud and he was friendly and sweet. And I had a good relationship I have with all of my grandchildren. But he was really happy to see me. And I remember him as a younger kid, with all kinds of stories that I remember. It's not.
And I remember you
not
also.
Not for the radio, but it's in my head. Yeah.
You also talk about your head. You also crocheted a hat for him, didn't you?
Yes.
To keep him warm.
No, I didn't make any more. There were nuts. I'd been crocheting for many years, and I did tremendous. I taught a crocheting class here where I live for 4 years. But the hat, the program for the hat is a pain in the neck. I made another one. I donated, and then I'm doing other things.
Gave it up. But you do so much else. Sarah is actually an activist, and the work she does is unbelievable. And she is a living example of how generational trauma can evolve into generational resilience. You have just turned 88. Am I correct?
I'm just 88. By the Hebrew calendar, it'll be this coming Saturday. By the English calendar, it was March 28th. Which I happen to have been lying in a hospital bed having a small procedure, not a surgery. They call it a procedure.
Baruch Hashem, you're going to be seeing your Hebrew birthday then on Shabbos too. Now, Sarah, you and your sister, Hadassah, brought out a book which you gave to Yad Vashem, and it's called Fleeing Europe, The Miracle of Our Holocaust Survival and the Kindling of Our Zionism. I need to first of all say that Dr. Les Glassman introduced Sarah and I. And if you would like to see YouTubes of Sarah and of her family and also all her parents and everything, please look on Dr. Les Glassman's YouTube channel and you'll see there Sarah Goodman, and you can pick up all her pictures and see her for yourself there. Right. Yes. Tell me about your growing up years. I mean, it's fascinating. When trying to keep ahead of the Nazis all the time. Yes. Would you mind starting with that?
No, I can tell it in bits and pieces, or I can tell the whole story. I was very young. I was very young, and I'm being written about in our local newspaper for the Holocaust Memorial Day. And they kept saying, what do I remember? Well, I don't remember. In the book, there are memories of my sister who was 4 years older. At 2.5, you don't remember when you get to be 88. Now, some things I remembered, we wrote the book 20 years ago. The book has things that I remembered that in the meantime, I remember that I remembered them, if I can say such a thing. But it's not current memory. I was very fortunate that my parents, we didn't even realize it in our childhood. And the years we were living with them, we never realized how unbelievably brilliant they were and what they did. After we wrote the book and I'm lecturing for 20 years, I'm at the point where I say, I didn't give them enough honor. I should have been super, super special with them. And of course, we had a good relationship, but it's incredible. It starts out before the Holocaust years. My sister Susan was born in 1932.
And she was 4 years older than you.
It's before and in the hospital in Germany. She was actually born in Dusseldorf and I was born in Dortmund. Why they moved from one town to the other, I never heard. But when my mother was pregnant with me, in the meantime, the Nazis had passed these horrible Nuremberg laws, whose only object was to make life impossible for Jews by canceling all their civilian rights. Now, it's a long list, and I wouldn't want to tell it, the whole long list. I don't know it. I only know the things that affected us. And to begin with, hospital use was forbidden to Jews, no matter what was the reason. So my mother realizes she's in her 8th month, and I'm she realized, she can't go to the hospital like she did with Susan. So, okay, she'll have the birth at home. Oh, that's fine. She'll go get a nurse or somebody to help. And then they think, wait a minute, they don't want a 4-year-old child to be hanging around. It's not appropriate. She might see something, hear something. Sounds very reasonable. They send her off to an aunt. Okay. A loving aunt lives maybe right not far, took wonderful care of her. Now, I explained this. It sounds very reasonable. The problem is, at that time, they didn't realize they should bring her home as fast as possible. Because for her, as a little kid, she doesn't know what she's doing now at home. And the young child interprets it as a type of rejection. Absolutely. And my mother had to recuperate, and they didn't have the knowledge of psychology we have today. So they left a couple of weeks with the aunt. And this was the beginning of my older sister's problems, because it did something, and none of us realized it. Okay, life goes on. My father owns a store that he had learned. He had been sent to Germany from Poland to learn with an uncle tailoring, because the family in Poland, my father was born in Poland, Mikulichin, the whole world was suffering from a difficult situation. They didn't have enough income. He went to learn a trade, and he learned with his uncle to become a tailor. And in Germany, when he became, as an adult, he met my mother. When he decided to do something, he opened a shop. Many people obviously sold at home in those days. It's not, they didn't have the ready-to-wear we have now.
We're going to get back to that in a minute.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
This is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program on 101.9 High FM. My guest today is Sarah Lustig Goodman, and she's in Jerusalem and I'm in Johannesburg, and we have connected with each other. We have been in touch with each other on WhatsApp, but it's just so good to be seeing each other. Sarah is telling us the story of how she and her sister, Susan, who is 4 years older than her, and her parents, what happened before they had to leave Germany and dodge the Nazis wherever they went. So go on, please.
So my father had a shop selling material, and over the shop was an apartment, and we lived over the shop. and between the two were internal staircases. That's, you can see such arrangements anywhere today. And everything's fine until the big famous Night of the Broken Glass, we call it in English. People know the name Kristallnacht, which is the German name, because there was so much broken glass. And there was a tremendous rioting, and a lot of Germans, police and just Germans went crazy wild, arrested Jews, killed Jews, broke shops. It's a very firm and famous day. And the date is November 1938, when I'm 2 and a half, and Susan is 6 and a half. And we're asleep when my sister Susan is the first one to wake up from the noises and runs to her parents to wake them and say, what's going on? There's noises. My father, with some instinct, grabbed his winter coat. And my mother said this helped him because the Nazis broke into the store. Someone in the area had said, that shop is owned by a Jew. Obviously, there isn't a sign outside. And they went looking for these. So they wrecked the shop and they decided, at that point, they were arresting only the men. In order to arrest them, the method that they use is to toss them down the steps. So therefore, the coat protected him. Mm-hmm. I don't imagine there were very big steps between two floors. But in any case, and they drag him off. This is 38. The camps do not exist. They just have small local jails. In Dortmund, was not the big city it is today. They dragged him off to jail. And my mother doesn't know what to do first. There she is in this wreck. So her first thought is to go and bring him clothing. And they took him in pajamas. And with the clothing, she takes his watch. And some guy working in that jail, and this was not really the Nazis. Maybe it was a normal person. I don't know who was there. But he very kindly told her, don't give him the watch. It won't last. We're taking them to a work camp. She goes home with the watch and think, what's a work camp? Never heard of such a thing. Today, we understand looking at this history. But when you're living in the middle in 1938, you have no idea what's ahead of us. So she goes home and she thinks something very bad is going on. Not being allowed to be in the hospital was another clue. And she decides she's got to get us out. Now, this is a huge, huge thing. If you know your women's movement, you know that in those years, women did not make private decisions without asking the husband. How can you ask the husband if he's sitting in jail locked up and there's no visiting? And she asked for advice from friends and neighbors. Her own parents were no longer there because they had decided when the Nazi new government with Hitler went into. In 1933, they went to what was then called Palestine, our Israel today. And they encouraged the whole family to go. But the other, not everybody could manage it for all kinds of reasons. Anyway, so she got advice. Find out where you can send the girls. Maybe you have relatives somewhere. So she remembered Frisch family in Belgium. And she calls them up. And I tell children, yes, we already had phones in those days. She calls them up. They are also having two little girls about the same age. And they make a plan. They're going to send to Germany the woman that helps them with the kids, the nursemaid, with the papers that belong to the Frisch girls, Susan and Denise, and she's going to take us back. We're not using fake passports. We're just using somebody else's. And that was the plan and was brilliant. My mother had them to give your children away when you think there's a threat. This is something, it's in the Bible stories, but it's not something you hear every day.
No.
You, of course, didn't know the nursemaid. I don't even know her name. And we were not given any explanation. In those days, you didn't tell kids anything. You just took them from A to B. So here we are on the train with this nice lady. And whoever asks her, she tells them a huge fake story that were Belgian kids who were taken to Germany to see some special doctor and are going home. Had it been caught that it's a trick, or there would have been the end of all three of us. It's not a big trip because that part of Germany is close to the Belgian border. And we get there safely. And at some point, as any two-year-old, I started chattering. And my sister was clever enough to realize to shut me up because I'm chattering in German. And I'm supposed to be a
Belgian. Oh, my word.
Somebody might have caught on.
Yeah.
My sister is only 6 and a half, but I know she shut me up somehow. Okay, so we get to this lovely family. They have two girls, also in a small apartment. They don't really have room for two more. So I get to stay with them. And Susan goes to their brother, who's on the same street, also lovely people. But bottom line, I'm 2 and a half with perfect strangers who don't speak German, and even my beloved big sister isn't with me. This must have been traumatic. I don't recall. Whatever happened to me, I overcame with time. And my mother gets a phone call that we've arrived safe. Okay. Now she makes a big decision. She's got to get her husband out of the jail. Whoever heard of such a thing? In 1938, out of a government jail? where does she come with such an idea? And she's asking advice and asking advice, and people tell her, in those days, you were allowed to leave Germany if you had papers to prove you had where to go. Now, she had visa. She had visa for the States. We had tried also to join the grandparents in Israel, in Palestine, but the British wouldn't allow it. Now, the visa she had were no longer dated. They were outdated. And she only had three because the Americans gave them according to source of country. And my father, Polish born, never got one. And that's why they didn't use them. They didn't want to separate. So she thinks she has three. And the date is no good and she needs a fourth one. So she decides she doesn't know what to do. And people tell her about a forger. What's a forger? My mother was civilized. She never dealt with people like that. She goes to a forger. And he makes her a fourth visa, and he corrects the dates and hours. In the meantime, she did something unbelievable. The shop is wrecked. The bank accounts of Jews were either emptied or sealed. Whatever money had been in the shop was taken. And here she needs money. She wants to go and bribe to get my father out. So she went to customers. Now, their customers were buying on installments. She picked everything. Her husband didn't give her advice. He's sitting in jail. She picked herself up and went from people that she knew, the customer. And some of them knew the situation, knew things were heating up. And they said, no way. But she got money. And this money she used to get him out of jail after she showed them that she has visa. And they also used it to continue traveling. It's just unbelievable.
What determination.
I realize it more and more because I've been interviewed and I've been asked questions and I went back to look in the book and suddenly I remembered something I had forgotten, that she went and collected money without him telling her, go collect money. This is just, anyway, she gets him out. Next idea, let's get out of Germany. People who love their children, don't just leave them with some relatives. Anyway, what was the point in staying in Germany? There were stores wrecked. Everything is forbidden. How can they get out? They're forbidden to use public transportation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the next new word that she learns is a smuggler. Then what's a smuggler? A guy will get you from A to B in a
To a smuggler. Wow, what determination.
Other vocabulary. Where are they going to meet him? They got to meet him in a different town. He's now in Dortmund. And the way they get to the town, they don't have a car. They have to get a train, but they're not allowed to go on the train. So they get advice. Now, what they did will sound absolutely incredible. And this year, I've been speaking for 20 years. I've spoken to all kinds of groups. This year, people always talk to me after I finish. Somebody in the audience came and told me he heard the same story in his family. What's the story? They were told to ride underneath the train. How do you do that? First of all, the train...
Underneath where the rails are, you mean?
Well, there were long bars that were just sitting there. And they had to lie on the bar and hold on. The train itself was not sitting in a ditch like today. But the whole train was on the surface. And the speed was a third of what it is today.
And they had to hold on for
life. The investigations in the train stations were not done at the entrance. They could just breeze into the state. Here in Israel, we had a period when we were checking people coming in. There, they checked whoever's sitting actually on the train. So they breezed. They found the train that went to where...
We're going to get back to that story in a moment.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
This is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program on 101.9 High FM Radio. My guest today is Sarah Lustig Goodman, and we are talking about her unbelievable parents right now and their escape from Germany, one step ahead of the Nazis everywhere. And Sarah is telling us about how her parents had to go underneath the train. They were not allowed on the train, being Jews. So they were told they had to go under the train and hold on for dear life. I can't believe that story. Wow. Sarah, go on.
This was advice of a secret way. The Nazis would have seen them. They would have taken them, obviously. They had to go find the right train and sneak themselves under. Now, if you travel like that, you cannot take children and you cannot take bags and package, only what's on your body. And the train stopped here now and then, and they could take a deeper breath. And as I said, it wasn't the highest speeds of today. And when they got to the town they wanted, they got down. They must have been dirty. And the train shakes. I mean, my mother was always fastidious and elegant as I knew her. And they walked out of the station and nobody noticed the people crawling out from under the train. I call this another one of our many, many miracles. To travel under a train and not fall, not killed on the way, and then to go in and out and not be seen. My story is full of miracles. I say someone was definitely looking out for us. So they meet the smuggler, next interesting state. He has a big truck with merchandise. His merchandise is wooden logs. There's a small cabin for the driver. In between, there's a hidden cabin that he built or somebody helped him build. From the outside, you don't see anything. He shoved them in there. They should stand straight and not move and not breathe and not talk. And then he pushes two more girls in, Jewish girls, who had also paid him. And he says, be quiet. And he starts driving. Of course, very quickly, there's a checkup, a spot. And the Nazi police, whatever they were, ask him for his documents. And they look at the merchant. It's too much to take it out. Okay, they say, you can go. But just to be sure, as he's driving off, they pull out their pistols and they go, bang, bang, into the truck, into the van, whatever it was. No, the four hidden passengers heard this. No one was hurt. They understood what it was. He keeps driving and driving. And as soon as he's far enough away, this is another wise guy. He stops. And he must have had a little window between them. He tells them, I need more money. Look what's happening to my merchandise. It's so dangerous. They gave him more money. What could they do? And they continue traveling. And then a lot of
talk. And what about the girls? What happened to the girls?
They paid something. Now, my parents did not speak to these girls because they were not allowed to speak. They had to be quiet, quiet, quiet. There was a second stop, the same scene, again, more money. The third stop, in the meantime, he's progressing. He's getting to where they're going to get off. The third time, the girls say, sorry, we're out of it. And he said, okay, get out. My father and mother could not see this. They don't know the girls. They're not connected. They don't know how long their own money will last, but they paid for the girls. Oh. They did a huge, huge good deed. In Hebrew, we call that a mitzvah.
Absolutely.
People who know some Hebrew, I'm saying that. And the girls said, goodbye, goodbye, and thank you, and thank you. I don't know their names. I don't know exactly how old they were. 16, 17, something like that. I don't know where they ended up their lives. I just know this piece that my parents. Now, he stopped his vehicle at the border, and he knew exactly where there was a piece of border that there were no guards. This was a place to let them off, and they walked across, and they went into the town. Now, the Fish family were waiting because they'd heard they were coming, but they didn't believe they'd actually make it. And then, of course, my sister was with me, and the other Fish brother, Max Fish, whatever his name was, with us. They're waving, and there's a knock on the door. And they open that door. And this is 3 months later. It's March 39. And I look at these people, and I don't know who they are. And after a few seconds, there's a click in my head, and I burst out crying. And that minute I cry, my sister Susan starts crying. And then, of course, my mother starts crying. And Mrs. Frisch. And there's a scene of hysterics, hysterical reunion. And this is a very important point. At that point, my father looks at this. He's excited. And he makes two absolutely important strategic decisions that carry us through the rest of it. He decides we will not stay in any country invaded by Nazis. Of course, in 39, he doesn't know yet how many countries they're going to invade. But this is his decision. And his other decision is we're not going to separate. Look what's happening. Look at this hysterics. Now, people who hear me tell me that's nonsense, not in his hands. No, it's true. Not that it's nonsense, but it's not completely in his control. But it moved them. Some people were planning to run, and they waited to sell something, to have money. Or they waited for someone to get over a flu or a cold, or who knows what reason. Waiting was always more dangerous. The point was to keep going ahead, 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 and getting away from the danger. Now, it took us 2.5 years. I count countries. We started in Germany, 1, Belgium, 2. France is next, then Spain, Portugal, 5 countries in Europe. From Europe, we ended up in Cuba, 6. From Cuba, we ended up in America, 7. And Israel is my 8th country on this trip.
Wow, that's
2.5 years through Europe. Every place they could, they sent me to school, my sister to school. And we were in places that the war hadn't hit yet. Now, in the book, we wrote about different things that happened on the way and different miracles. And we were in a tunnel that got bombed, and we were protected by the tunnel walls. And the biggest miracle was in France, in a city called, it'll come to me, was a man from Portugal who was sent there to be the representative, a consul. His name, a very famous name, is Alistair de Sousa Mendes. And his job was to give people permission to travel towards Portugal, not to Jews and not to other undesirables. I'm not going to explain what that is. Everyone can figure that out. And he was doing this and looking out the window and seeing the streets full of people with all kinds of not vehicles, pushing packages. They ended up making a film about him. If you see the film, you'll see what I'm talking about.
He was a Catholic, wasn't he?
He was a very religious Catholic. He had 11 children. And he decided to do, he explained it, that he would work with God against people and not with people against God. Now, he had something, and then that was the name of the book, something like that. A film. I was actually invited to be interviewed to be on the film, but of course, I don't remember meeting the man. I couldn't say too much. And he met this man who wrote the film, he wrote a documentary film. He met me with my sister who was born outside. Anyway, I was in Portugal. Let's get back to that. So we passed through Europe with all kinds of things happening. We get to Portugal. There's no war in Portugal. In Spain, you could see that they had a civil war before. In France, we met Sousa Mendes. Sousa Mendes gave us documents that helped us cross all the borders to get into Portugal.
Wow.
That's the point. And I'm on his list. Their family made a whole thing. They cleaned his name. 40 years after he died, Portugal said he was a hero and not a traitor. At the time, they arrested him. Of course, that was different, the government. Anyway, my father were in Portugal, was sitting there, and he's looking to get off burning Europe. So he's gone from one office to another, asking for a visa. England says no to Palestine and no to England. America's no. Everywhere he goes, he says no. My father is optimistic, and he goes again and again, and he gets to Cuba. And Cuba says, okay. So he comes home all excited. We're going to go to Cuba. Now we have to find a boat. And he goes looking for a boat. And one day he comes home. I got tickets to a boat. Happy days. We're making progress. We get ourselves together. And we go to the boat when the boat is ready. And this is 1941. And my father shows somebody at the entrance to the boat. I don't know exactly. They tell him, no, those seats are taken. Those places are taken. Yeah. In other words, some wise guy at sea sold double places.
Tickets. What a traitor.
My father's optimistic. We see the boat leaving without us. I don't remember this. I'm told this. And he says, there'll be another boat. I've optimism. I've gotten it from him. And we got another boat. And we left Portugal. And we got to Cuba. And after we got to Cuba on June 1st, on June 12th, my younger sister, Hadassah, was born in Havana Hospital.
Good.
In Cuba, my father said to people, he'd look at the port, he'd see some Jew, and he'd say, you want a kosher meal? Come to my house. One peso is like saying maybe $1, yeah? My mother at home did something, and from her own kitchen, as a child, I saw some pots that she had used. And he went back to the diamonds. While he was in Belgium, he learned to work with diamonds. His relatives took him in. And this is part of what's
for diamond, us. Diamond work.
Diamond. He learned to cut diamonds. And today I will say positive that this is why Cuba took us. Because this year I met two people who told me we also went from Portugal to Cuba after they heard me speak. And, oh, yeah, my father was in the diamonds. Cuba had a big diamond industry working with the States. It's only this year that I met two people who told me this, that I came to the obvious conclusion. Because otherwise, why would they say yes? Everybody else didn't want Jews. And also somebody told me that his family also talked about riding under a train. Now, I always knew it was true. I didn't see it written anywhere. But to hear somebody else say, my family talks about that, it said to me, I get a lot of satisfaction from speaking.
The courage of both your parents and you and Susan's resilience going from school to school, country to country. When you look back and when you look at little children and you think of them being moved like that, you can't actually believe it. It's amazing.
It's amazing. And we learned different languages and we went to different schools. My parents always knew that education was important. And 4 years in Cuba, we were in a Jewish school. How do I know this? One of the pictures of end of the year students were holding something that has a Jewish star on it, the Magen David. Now, I come to 1945, and we had an uncle living in the States who went there before World War One. In 1945, America allowed people in if somebody would say they're good people, they're not murderers, they're not thieves. And Uncle Leo Hausler, who was the brother of my grandmother, he guaranteed us, and that's how we got in. I don't know if today America is making such requests from all the floods of people who are coming in. Mm. But that's how we got in, and he had an apartment waiting for us, and he furnished it, but it was too small. My father quickly found a bigger place. Why do I say too small? We three girls slept in one bed. Susan and I, as the older ones, upright and down the length of the bed, and little Hadassah on the bottom. And she would tell stories that we kicked her. I'm sure there were stories. We all had a great laugh about it. We weren't that sick that we could have possibly kicked her. But that was the first year was on Amsterdam Avenue in Washington Heights. And we moved to Pinehurst Avenue, a much more prestigious neighborhood and much larger apartment.
Now, tell me about Israel, because our time will start running out. But I just wanted to say that I read this in the Jerusalem Post about you. It said, this woman never hesitates to stand up for what she believes in, wearing her ring wing banner as a badge of honor. She lobbied lawmakers in Washington, D.C. on behalf of terror victims and moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. They're talking about you. She protested. You protested the expulsion of Gush Katif in 2005. Wow, if only they'd heard your protest. And then you go on to say, I was once interviewed by a reporter from Holland. She seemed like quite an intelligent person. Yet she asked me why, after living in so many countries, I chose to live in Israel. And you went on to say that there was an obvious fact. And you said, I've actually got it printed here. You said, I gave her a proper answer. It's my homeland. It's our homeland. All of it. I lived many years in the States. And what I have here is something else. None of my children is looking to go anywhere else either. You can have a wonderful life here, a meaningful life as well. That's what you said.
That was before I lost a grandson in our current war. And I have to tell you, he was brought up with the love of the country from both sides of the grandparents. And my children, when I have a big birthday, make me a huge party, and they thank me that we came to Israel. Because we were back in the States.
And that we came to Israel. After losing.
And Yakir, the grandson that fell, his father told the grandmother, thank you for, and they made their way. They also ran away from Germany 3 days before that famous night, and they were in Argentina, and they came to Israel. So he had it from both sides. That his father, Yakir's father, actually said to his mother at the funeral, I still thank you for bringing us here. Despite that, I just buried one of my sons.
Look at that absolute determination that this is our land, Israel, right. And no one's going to take us off. Sarah, I know that you are invited to speak all over the place now, and you even went to Taiwan. And I know that you actually got a letter of condolence about Yakir when Yakir fell in December. And this says, Dear Miss Goodman, I was deeply saddened to hear the passing of your grandson, Yakir. And I would like to express my condolence. I can imagine how difficult this is for you and your family. And please know that I do care about you. Yakir was a fallen hero. He was a noble and courageous soul who used his flesh and blood to save his beloved country. It's a tragic loss. And I wanted you to know that you are in my thoughts, and Yakir's bravery will always be remembered. My sincerest condolences. And this was from Yaping Li, from the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in Tel Aviv. What a beautiful letter.
She knew me personally. I have, for the last 2 years, been connected to a wonderful young woman who's from Taiwan, and she's been living in Israel. And the story with her is we have an organization here that organizes for speakers to go to people's homes and speak. And they've been working with me, and they send me to homes where people invite neighbors and I speak. It's called Memory in the Living Room, some of the translation. And they told me they want me to meet somebody very influential. And I had no idea what they meant by that. It turns out that this young woman, Susan, is very influential because she has a blog that runs all the time with 3 million people in Chinese. Wow.
That's amazing. We're going to get back to that story in a moment.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
This is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program on 101.9 High FM. My guest today is Sarah Lustig Goodman, and she's in Jerusalem and I'm in Johannesburg, and we have connected with each other. We have been in touch with each other on WhatsApp, but it's just so good to be seeing each other. Sarah is telling us the story of how she and her sister, Susan, who is 4 years older than her, and her parents, what happened before they had to leave Germany and dodge the Nazis wherever they went. So go on, please.
And then they stopped. And her husband has some very important work that means that he's connected, even though they're very Sabbath observant, they're very strict. He knows when there's a serious problem immediately. In any case, they got ready to go to the synagogue, and I'm about to go, and they tell me, no, Ima, you're not going to the synagogue. You stay here, because if there's another siren, the distance from the synagogue to a safety place, which is by the dining room, would mean you'd have to run a bit, and they don't want me to do that at my age. Okay. So I stayed in the room. A little later, they came back, and the rest of the day was quiet. We had no radio on. We don't put anything on. But part of the guests by my daughter was a different son, and he's married with children, and he started getting calls that he's getting a special call for emergency army service. And he was told to wait, and then he got another message. And in the end, he didn't go till nightfall. But he lives near in his home, a private apartment with his wife and family, in near my area. So my son-in-law drove him and me, and his wife afterwards came back by herself with the kids in their car.
Gave a very profound answer. You remember what you said?
Yes, I know what I said, because I still feel it. In the Holocaust years, we were running and looking behind us. Today, we have a country with an army, a navy, and an air force that's strong. And we have built up an incredible country. We started with nothing. And we're surrounded by 22 Muslim countries, and none of them have invited their so-called relatives to come and join them. We took in people who were kicked out of Arab countries and the people who survived the Holocaust, either in the camps or somewhere else. And we built up a country from nothing. And these other Arabs are all sitting wherever they're sitting, and they don't want to invite them in. So it's a different kind of thing.
They won't invite the Palestinians in, are you saying?
Oh, why? Why? No. That would be the most normal thing. They could have this whole, we have a very funny story. We say Palestine didn't exist until it got occupied. There was never such a thing as Palestine.
Absolutely.
And all these so-called Palestinians don't have to be sitting and suffering. They can get up and go, but the other countries don't want them for some reason.
And they could have made it their own Tel Aviv there.
We've built up, we've done so much. I myself had a medical, they say it's not surgery, it's a procedure, which Israel invented, and now we're selling it to other countries. Last year, I had an eye operation. They told me it exists 8 years, invented in Israel. Mm-hmm. We have brains that are being used to help people. And to build them, if you all have families, my children get married and bring other babies into the world. Oh,
thank God. What does faith mean to you? Because I can see that you are a woman of faith. In order to have been able to go through what you've gone through, to lose a beloved grandson, to still believe that there's so much that you're still living for, and you're 88, what does faith mean to you?
I believe that all through my story, we got miracles happening to us. And all through these 6 months of war, I keep hearing unbelievable stories. And it has reawakened in some people a bit of Jewish faith that wasn't there before. We have soldiers who weren't doing any keeping anything, and suddenly they want a garment that Jews wear that's called tzitzit, because they realize suddenly the meaning. And my immediate reaction from the very beginning was, I know that God is with us, and he will get us out of this. We have to pay whatever we have to pay. We learn. We don't understand everything. We don't know what everything's happening, but I don't for a second think anything else. And I with my friend from Taiwan, Susan, I immediately said to her, it's obvious God is not going to, he helped us in previous wars. I heard from someone that they were going to hear in America, there's a special college for the army, I forget its name. And one of the students, it was an uncle of someone I know, said to the professor, you talk about all these wars, why don't you ever discuss the Israeli wars? And the big professor said, I cannot discuss miracle wars. I can't teach that.
Isn't that amazing? Can't teach miracle wars.
That's what he said.
And you know, Israel, without doubt, is a miracle country. And we in the diaspora.
I agree. We're going through a very difficult time. Now, Yakir was killed in December 4th, and his brothers were quickly released because the army tries not to have, God forbid, two victims from the same family. So they have to agree not to be, they're keen to participate, but they have to think of the family of their parents. So the other three are all married, but they don't have, they're young married, let's put it that way. One has three children, one has two. But the army released them. Oh, one of them, they gave them a job that has to do with supplies that's not in the battle area. But the whole
And how is Yakir's sister? How does she keep going? Because you said she's missing him so much.
My daughter was by me yesterday. It's hard. It's very hard.
Very hard. And are all your children...
At the funeral, she said he was a gift for 21 years.
Oh.
That's how she had him.
That's also such faith, isn't it? Are all your children...
You were asking about faith. I believe that we were chosen, and not chosen to have war. And we're doing things for the whole world. We have invented so many things that we share. And when there's a catastrophe, nature caused, a flood or a fire or who knows what, Israel is the first to run and help.
Absolutely.
I have a niece who's married to a doctor, and he wanted to go, and she didn't want to let him because they have a lot of kids at home. He wanted when something happened somewhere years ago, I remember, make people go and help. And we invent things, and we're helping the whole world. The fact that you and I are talking like this is a lot of it is based on Israeli inventions.
Absolutely, definitely. And that's what makes me so furious here in South Africa, that they choose to forget what Israel has actually given the world. My husband was in the Six-Day War in 67. We were not married then. And so, you know, even this war, it was quite unbelievable how many people, they didn't even call for people to come. And your airport, Ben Gurion, they were just coming. The flights kept coming with people coming to help. They still are.
There was a good Jew standing in the airport in New York who saw, and he offered to pay for some of them from his own pocket. You know, there are a lot of stories. It's our
And you are invited to talk to many people just before Holocaust Remembrance Day. Are you going to be in Jerusalem? In Jerusalem.
Every year I get allowed that week, but I talk during the year at different places, different times.
And so have you got a lot this week? I mean, next week?
It's early yet. I mean, some people wait for the last minute or somebody cancels, but I already got a few calls. And the big one is that I'm speaking, what did I tell you? I'm speaking on television on Channel 12.
I saw that.
I had a different obligation. I said to them, I don't like to play tricks on people. You have to call them and tell them and explain it. This is the organization that brings people. So she immediately could offer them someone else. And they said they understand that if I'm television, I'm reaching a much larger audience. This was a legal office of some kind that invited me. In the past, I was in the Weizmann Institute. I've spoken to soldiers. I was invited to Moscow. And on Zoom, I spoke to countries where I didn't go there. And in schools, And I read, because it's an escape story, I speak to children from third grade. It was a real horrible, the stories that people tell with the camps, they can't speak to children.
So you actually come with a miracle story, don't you? And
yes.
I'm sure the children love that coming from you. I can imagine.
And also,
because
through the book, which we never put up for sale, and I never asked to be paid to speak, because my purpose and my sister's purpose in writing the book was twofold, to honor our parents and to inform our children. Because the children started asking, and it's much too much to give each one a long story. But this way they take the book. Now, one of them was taken from school on a trip to visit in Europe. They go on the march. They go
the March of the Living.
On the plane, he took out my book and read some piece of it to his classmates. Now, the book is in two languages, so he could read it in the Hebrew.
It's amazing.
And I give a book to each new baby, and I also give a book to the parents of the future mate when somebody gets engaged to the bride or groom. The parents, I give them a gift of a copy of the book. They should know.
Wonderful. So they can at least see the history of your family. I think it's a wonderful idea. But Sarah, we're going to be told to close in a moment. But I just want to wish you a year of strength that you've had your operation, your procedure that you had. You're about to turn 88 on your Hebrew birthday. You are 88 on your English birthday. You are remarkable. It's speaking to you. I could go on and on and on, but we are being told to keep quiet now. I will be in touch with you. This particular program will be on next Tuesday, and it will be live then, but I will send you the podcast and let you know also when it's going to be on.
Yeah.
You know, the Baal Shem Tov said something which really, to me, it spoke to me of you. It said, "Let me fall if I must fall. The one I become will catch me." And I think that's your story. The person that you have become has been through all these unbelievable miracles, the pain and the joy of your life have come
yes,
together.
And they're all here. They're all following our way. They're all keeping the religion the way we do, you know, Sabbath and the holidays and everything. And they're all doing important, good things. I'm very proud of them.
I'm sure, and they're probably very proud of you.
I just say I'm so blessed, I'm not stressed.
I like that. But I'm sure they're very proud of you. I must admit, Les Glassman is very proud of you. And having now met you, I'm also very proud of you.
It's a big honor.
Anyone listening in, go on to Les Glassman's YouTube channel and you will pick up Sarah's photograph. You'll see what she looks like. She'll give you a talk on it. And also photographs of your family are on Les's YouTube, which is fantastic. Thank you so much for being with
Thank
Sarah.
You.